I'll think about after class. But you can put a mass insertion on both sides. Anyways, but there is a, if nothing else, there is a wave function normalization, and I think it also appears at two loops. You guys found a two loop. Yeah, there is a two loop diagram that connects all the arrows.
They found the diagram.
Yeah, that two loop is pretty difficult. I mean, maybe I mentioned. Okay, why don't we get started? And today we'll start to try to understand what we found last time. So let's just see what we found last time, and then we'll interpret it in a few ways. So what we looked at last time was the correction to the scalar two-point function, right? So the two diagrams that we looked at was this one, where you have the scalar coming in and scalar coming out, and there is a loop in between, right? So that was one diagram, and we'll see in a moment what it equals to. And then the other diagram was scalar coming in, and a fermion loop inside. And if I keep track of the arrows, it should be something like that, okay? And then I remind you that there is really also a third diagram where you put a counter term, right? So in field theory, you don't just have those things. You also need to have a diagram with a counter term. And that counter term has a structure which has a mass term and also a part that absorbs whatever has to do with the momentum, right? So we usually write it something like delta z, which goes with the p square. There is an I in front, plus a delta m, which doesn't go with anything. And the meaning is that this piece, as we'll see in a moment, this piece just absorbs whatever divergences you regularized, which had no momentum dependence in them. And this piece, delta z, is regularizing whatever divergences you find that have to do with terms that are dependent on momentum. Okay, so that's the usual form of the two-point counter term. All right, so now let's see what we found. So for this diagram, if we do it correctly, and I think it comes out something like plus lambda integral over k, right? So that's a simple diagram, 1 over k square minus m square, okay? And that's before. So I think after you shift the weak rotation, there is an i here. After you do the weak rotation, okay? And for this diagram, we found that if you do things correctly, you have to be careful. There is a minus sign. There is a minus sign from the having a loop of fermions. Whenever you have a loop of fermions, there has to be a minus sign. It comes from the way you commute the operators at this order, and it comes out to be something like minus 4i y square integral over d4k 2 pi to the fourth integral dx, and then we have here k square minus x 1 minus x m square and times k square minus delta square. And this delta I think comes out to be, so delta is equal to x minus 1 p square. So this should be p square. Plus m square. Okay? All right, so I remind you the way you get this is you actually have two propagators, right? You have the propagator for this fermion, and you have the propagator for this fermion, and they have different momenta. And then you just do the Feynman parameters. You combine those two numerators into a single numerator, sorry, a single denominator. And the power here just reminds you of the fact that there were really secretly two different propagators there. Okay? So now, whenever you calculate these sort of diagrams, this is roughly the kind of things you'll see, yeah. So I think there's a two from here. Where did I get the other two from? I think there was a symmetry factor that you need to account for that gave you another two, because there is I think it comes out to be a four, but we can check it out later. But let's try to understand again what is the meaning of that. To look if whether you have divergences, the easiest way is to ask yourself what happens at high energies. What happens to this integral? So forget about the dx integral. That's not important. That's just numerics. But the important thing is that you have an integral on momenta which runs all the way to infinity. So what happens to those integrals at the highest momenta? You see that this integral is clearly divergent, right? Because d4k is k square, goes like k square dk square. So this integral is clearly divergent. But also this integral, even though it has a higher power in the denominator, it also has an extra piece of k square in the numerator. So it's also UV divergent. So both diagrams are UV divergent in a quadratic way. All right? But there is something interesting about it. So very naively, this thing goes like I lambda square over 16 pi square cutoff square. And this diagram, if you just look at the largest divergence, goes something like minus I 2y square over 16 pi square lambda square. And I just put in, I wrote the 4 as a 2y square for a reason you'll see in a moment. Right? So this is roughly how it goes like. Now, stirring it for a while, there is something clear that one can do, right? Even without any counter terms, what could you do? What could you require of your theory to get rid of this harmful behavior? Huh? Lambda equal to y or half y, right? 2y, yeah. Right, so just staring at it, even forgetting about renormalization, regularization, all those things, it's clear that there is some very simple choice, namely lambda equal to 2y, that cancels those divergences, right? Now, if you look back at your Lagrangian, that is a relation between the quartic term, lambda phi to the fourth, there was a four here, and the Yokawa term, which was y, half y, phi star psi psi. So now we found that if in fact there is a relation between this Yokawa coupling and this quartic coupling, this sensitivity to the ultraviolet physics disappears. Right? The reason why we find this, behavior, and we'll see it more explicitly in a moment, why we find this behavior concerning, is because it means that you're quadratically sensitive to whatever new particles you might have at high energies. And it means, for example, for the Higgs potentials, and that's where we're heading towards, that if we're thinking, so here is my Higgs, right? It's a scalar particle. It will get the same sort of corrections. This is the Higgs self-coupling. This is the Higgs coupling to tops, for example. You can ask, why is the Higgs at the electroweak scale? Why is the Higgs only weighing 100 GeV? Because from these calculations, we see that we get corrections to the Higgs mass, right? This will be a direct, the way you'll absorb it, you'll absorb it into this counter term, the counter term that has to do with the Higgs mass. You'll have to absorb both of those infinities into the Higgs mass counterterm. And so you can do it. Formally, you can do it. You can go around shuffling those infinities into the counterterm. But then you have to ask yourself, why is it that this will be as large as the high energy behavior, right? For example, the grand unified scale or the Planck scale or whatever very high scale you have. And so how come the Higgs, even though it has those huge corrections to its mass, how come it's so light? Well, the way you'll have to do it in practice is that if you start at a high energy scale, something has to be very finely tuned between the terms that enter into the counterterm, right? You have to have some very, very fine-tuned choice between your Burr mass of the theory. Remember, the Burr mass is the mass of the Higgs at the cutoff. You have to have a very fine-tuned choice between the Burr mass and all the quantum corrections, because all the quantum corrections will go like this cutoff. So very, very, very explicitly, we see that the quantum corrections will give you something that goes like the cutoff divided by 16 pi square times lambda, right? And that you will have to add to your Burr mass. This will have to be added to M0 squared, the Higgs mass at the gut scale or at the Planck scale. And somehow when you add those two things together, maybe there is a minus sign here, somehow when you add those two things together, you should get 100 GeV square. Right, because that's the actual physical Higgs mass. And when this thing is the gut scale, so that's Planck scale or gut scale, 10 to the 16 GeV square, you see you have to subtract 10 to the 16 from 10 to the 16 to get something which is only 100. And it gets squared, right? So you have to fine-tune this number against this number to some 32 digits. And it's all coming roughly from the fact that your divergences go like the cutoff. Right? So let's pause here and see if you have any questions, because this is the crucial, this is what's called the hierarchy problem. This is why people talk about supersymmetry and all that stuff. Yeah. We'll do that in a moment. I'll do that in a moment. You'll see how this shows up in DIMREG. But do you understand what I'm trying to say? If it's really true that the quantum corrections to the Higgs mass, this will be the quantum correction to the Higgs mass, is as big as the cutoff of your theory. The cutoff of your theory maybe is the Planck scale, maybe is the gut scale. That means that the correction, the quantum correction to the Higgs mass will be of this order. Now you can cancel it. It's true that you can cancel it against the Burr mass. You can believe that somehow at the gut scale, the mass of the Higgs is also huge. But somehow this contribution exactly cancels against this contribution. And it cancels so finely that you go down by 16 orders of magnitude. Right? It's like getting a factor, taking the number a million, right? And subtracting from a million or 999, right? That will give me one. But you had to choose this number very, very carefully to 6 decimal points to get this huge reduction in scale. Here it's even worse because it's 10 to the 16 compared to 100 and it gets squared. All right, so this is the hierarchy problem. Yeah. What is that? So that's a great question. So what do we mean by problem? After all, this is just a pure number. Why should I, as a human being, worry about pure numbers? I mean, maybe it's just the way this is. I mean, maybe there was just some very, very fine-tuned choice at the gut scale, and that's the way the universe is. And that's an excellent point. Ultimately, you're right. There could be that nature is just like that. One of the reasons that we are worried about it is we haven't really seen it anywhere else in nature. We have seen scalars before. For example, pions are scalars. And whenever we saw scalars light, whenever we saw that scalars are lighter than what they should be by this argument, there was always some symmetry that protected them and made them light. So in the case of the pions, this is what's called the shift symmetry or the chiral symmetry that made them light. They're what's called pseudo-Goldstone bosons. But you're right. Ultimately, this is not a physics argument. This is a pure number argument. But it seems hard to digest that somehow the Higgs was chosen just right in nature to be much, much lighter than what it ought to be. And we haven't seen it anywhere else. The only other places we have seen it, there were real good reasons why it was so much light, namely symmetry reasons. But you're absolutely right, and you should be skeptical. You should always be skeptical about those sort of arguments, because ultimately, it's not physics. This is a pure number. Yeah. Right.
And the gravitational mass were exactly the same, and Newton could not explain that. And which ultimately led to a bigger symmetry, which is symmetry of that general relativity.
Yeah, that's an interesting analogy, yeah. So the idea is, you know, from a young age you learn about F equal to ma, and you also learn about that the force of gravity is gmm over r, and you very casually go around and you cancel the two m's. You say the m that appears in ma is the same as the m that is happening in gmm over r, but really there's no reason for it, right? Like this m. So the gravitational force of Newton, and this is a statement about the force. This is a statement about inertia, right? Why is it that this little m has anything to do with this little m? It turns out that it does, and it turns out that it does to amazing precision, right? Empirically. Now, from general relativity's point of view, this has to be the case. Those two things are the same. Right, the gravitational mass is the same as the inertial mass. But a priori, before we had general relativity, it's not clear why this is the case. So yeah, that's right. So it's something like that we feel uncomfortable when something that really ought not to be like that from the theory just comes out to be like that numerically. We feel uncomfortable about very small or very large numbers. But that being said, keep in mind, for example, neutrinos are extremely light. We don't quite know why they are like that. There could be one explanation that explains it very well, and that's the CISO mechanism. But it could be that just the Yokawa coupling is very small. The Yokawa coupling for the electron is very small. It's a very small number. So ultimately, this is an argument about pure numbers, and it's a pure number. Any other question about the hierarchy problem? We'll see another way of interpreting it in a moment, but you understand what was happening here, right? This is the quantum correction. This is the quantum correction to the mass. So somehow I have to absorb this infinity into the counter term. Okay, but you should be a little skeptical about it, because this is the result of a specific way of regularizing the integral, right? I chose a hard cutoff to make this integral into a finite integral. What if I've chosen a different way? What if I've chosen dimensional regularization? Will I still see this infinity? If I don't see that, quadratic divergence. If I don't see this quadratic divergence, maybe this is just an artifact of the way I decide to get rid of the infinity, in which case it's completely unphysical. So now what I'll try to show you is to convince you that, in fact, this thing shows up in dimensional regularization as well, although it's a little more subtle. Okay? So have you seen dimensional regularization before? You remember roughly what you do? So let me go over it a little more carefully. Okay, so the way we do dimensional regularization is, the reason why this is divergent is because of this k square here, right? If the dimension of the integral was only, let's say, dk, then this won't be divergent, right? Dk, for example, dk over k square is not divergent. Right, the behavior at infinity is perfectly regularized. So if somehow I can lower the dimensions of the integral, instead of putting a 4 here, I'll put a d, general dimension, then I can make this integral finite by just going to lower dimensions. Now you may be worried, I mean, what do you mean? We live in a four-dimensional world. What does this procedure mean? Well, at some level, it might just mean you don't really know what happens at high energies. Maybe at high energies, you really do go to some lower dimension. That's all you need, right? Because all the problems are appearing at the highest energies, right? At the upper limit of the integral. The lower limit of the integral is perfectly fine. So we can do that, and that's known as dimensional regularization. You choose D to be 4 minus 2 epsilon, and you formally do all your integral as if they are convergent, right? And at the end of the day, you take epsilon to 0 to go back to 4 dimensions. And you will encounter infinities, and we'll see where those infinities are, okay? So let me skip one particular detail. So the one thing you do have to worry when you do that is that in different dimensions, the mass dimensions of those couplings, lambda and y, changes. Okay, so in 4 dimensions, lambda and y are dimensionless quantities. In higher or lower dimensions, that actually changes. And so you need to introduce a new scale. So I'm going to skip the technical detail. If you want, you can ask me about it. It's not going to be relevant at all for any of the discussions. So that's why I don't want to delve into it. But it's something you do have to account. So let's see what happens to this integral. So the way you do it in dimensional regularization, you say lambda actually becomes lambda times mu to the 2 epsilon. The I remains. And now this integral becomes d dk 2 pi d and 1 over k square minus m square. Okay. And in dimensional regularization, this result is just given in terms of gamma function, and it's equal to this part I just copy, lambda mu to the 2 epsilon. So mu is just some new scale, okay, that make this coupling that's set in front suddenly a dimensionful quantity. So this is the technical details that I'm going to skip, but it really won't matter for anything we're going to do. Okay. The more important thing is that this integral is now a known quantity. It's minus 1 times I. I think I have too many I's. So this I is coming when I write this as Euclidean. But if I don't write this on Euclidean, there is no I. That I is what I get from here. So I just have 4 pi d over 2, gamma of 1 minus d over 2 over gamma of 1, 1 over m square 1 minus d over 2. Okay? So this is the result. Now, this part is fine. Minus 1 I is just a number. 4 pi d over 2 is just a number. Where did the trouble come? Where does the infinity come from? It's coming from the fact that the gamma function, remember that gamma of n is n minus 1 factorial, right? Gamma of 0 is actually infinity. Gamma of minus 1 is also infinity, right? And this is exactly what's going to happen here when I send epsilon to 0, because the number of dimensions goes to 4, and I have 1 minus 2. That's gamma of minus 1. And so this infinity, here the infinity was when I send the hard cutoff to infinity, right? The infinity in dimensional regularization is happening when you send epsilon to 0, right? When epsilon goes to 0, d goes to 4. And you see that you get an infinity from the gamma function. Now, it's the same kind of infinity that you always get in field theory. It's something that you don't have to worry too much about. It just says that you have some sensitivity to the high energy physics, right? and you have to absorb it into physical parameters. We know that this is the case for any kind of physics, right? When Bohr constructed these atoms, he didn't care what happens to the nucleus. He just absorbed all the effects of the nucleus into a charge, right? Whatever it is, it's just some charge and some mass. So the mass actually doesn't matter for the atom. And that's it. And when you talk about a string, when you talk about the vibrations of a string, you don't talk about how the molecules interact with each other. You don't talk about what kind of forces happen between atoms. You just say, here is a string. It has a tension. It has a mass density. And that's it, right? The tension and the mass density of a string describes the physics entirely. And all those effects that have to do with molecules and atoms and forces and all that thing gets absorbed into two parameters, two phenomenological parameters, the string tension and the mass density. So very similarly, it shouldn't bother you too much that we are getting some answers which are sensitive to the high energy physics. We'll just absorb all of them into the masses, the couplings, and all those things. This is the usual statements of renormalization. But the thing that you should worry a little bit about is how come here we got some things that is sensitive to the very high energy physics, lambda square, right? And here I don't have any dimension except for the mass of the particle itself. If you work out things correctly, you'll find out that this answer is indeed divergent, but it goes like the mass of the particle, right? When d goes to 4, this thing will go like m square. Okay, times some gamma function that diverges, something that looks like minus 1 plus epsilon or 2 epsilon. Okay, the answer will roughly be the mass of the particle square times some things that diverges. Yeah. Is what just epsilon? It could be just epsilon. It will be just something that goes like gamma of minus 1 and epsilon goes to 0. So, but the thing that I want to pay to bring your attention, that here we seem to be getting that the Higgs mass is only sensitive to the Higgs mass itself, right? The divergence goes like m squared times something that diverges. Here we seem to be seeing some direct cutoff sensitivity. So what gives? Now, you should be worried about it because you can say something like, and people have said that, and people are working on these sort of ideas. They can say something like this. And look, this whole cutoff sensitivity business is nonsense. Because I have a perfectly legitimate other way of regularizing it, where I don't see any high energy physics. I have something that I have to regularize. That's fine. Here it is. But other than that, I'm just sensitive to the scale of my low energy physics, just the Higgs mass, right? And what they have to imagine in that case is somehow there are no other scales at high energies. But somehow the theory becomes a conformal theory, a scale invariant theory at high energies. There is no other scale, and so the only scale that they can be sensitive to is the mass square of the Higgs itself. And they say, okay, so this whole hierarchy problem is mute. There is nothing in there, right? I have a perfectly legitimate way of doing my theory where I don't see any of the high energy physics. So this is true to some extent, but it's ignoring some things that we already know. Now, what is the problem with it? It is true that if this was your entire theory, if you knew nothing else, then it's perfectly fine to say that the only scale in your theory is the mass of the particle itself. And then the hierarchy problem is not really there because you have another way of regularizing it which you don't see it. The problem is that we do know about the Planck scale. We do know that there are higher scales, like for example, the mass of the neutrinos that should be at much, much higher, the right-handed neutrinos. We do know that there are other scales in physics that are much higher than the electroweak scale. Now, how will that manifest itself? Here we only considered the mass of the correction due to the Higgs itself. But suppose there was really some God scale where there are new particles or some gravity scale where there are some new particles. And then this particle here that I drew in the loop will be some new heavy particle, right? Quantum mechanics feels all the particles that are in the spectrum, including the very heavy ones. And so I'll have a new correction due to some new particle, some new scalar that is very heavy. You don't see it in any experiment, but it does correct your Higgs mass. The only change to this computation is that now you'll have, instead of the mass square of the Higgs here that came from the propagator, you'll have some new mass scale. Let's call it gut scale square. And you'll go through the same rigmarole of doing dimensional relocalization and all that. And the only change you'll find is that suddenly this goes like gut scale. And now it stares in your face, because now the answer will actually go like gut scale square and no longer just Higgs mass. And so this is exactly where this way of cheating, of saying I just have dimensional regularization so I don't have the high energy scale, that's where it fails. Because if you have any kind of new physics at high energies, it will affect your quantum mechanics, whether you like it or not. And you will see the effects of it at loop level. Yeah. Yes, so people are discussing it. It's a little hard to digest that somehow, you know, even gravity doesn't correct anything. But it is a logical possibility. It is a logical possibility that maybe there is, that's an indication that there is nothing else.
But we do have dark matter.
Right, we have dark matter, there is the dark energy, but you know, you can say, well, we don't really know what those things are. They're on such large scales. Maybe it's some modification of gravity. It's important to keep in mind what we know, to keep separate what we know empirically and what we don't know empirically. This is mostly just plausibility arguments. But even those people who like to discuss this possibility of no scale at high energies, sometimes they forget this issue that, you know, if you have any kind of physics at high scale, like gut scale or Planck scale, then you're in trouble. And most of the attempts so far to actually make this a realizable thing run into problems like that. Yeah. Right. So you have some divergence, but the scale that you see in your theory is just the scale, the mass of the Higgs itself, right? It's proportional. The result is proportional to m square. So in particular, m square, if m square is zero, if in your original Lagrangian, if m square is just zero, this correction will not be there. You're worried. Okay, what does it matter what scale? You're saying, what does it matter what scale is sitting here, right? This could be gut scale. This could be my grandmother's scale. But you have an infinity sitting in front of it. The infinity multiplied by anything will be large, except if that something that is multiplying it by is just zero. If the mass is just zero, then there was no correction, right? And so if you have some theories that at high energy, the mass of the Higgs actually becomes zero or there's no scale in the problem, then it is true that you will have no such correction.
And is it sure, if the mass is zero, that indeed it should be zero, or does it mean that dimensional regularization does not work?
No. Then there is an enhanced symmetry in the problem. When really there is no mass to the Higgs and there is no quartic, then there is a scale invariant theory.
And how do you explain then such a divergence in the mass?
How do you explain what? No, but as I'm saying, so, well, this if you, go to that limit, you also have to get rid of this coupling, right? Then there is a shift symmetry in the theory where phi goes to phi plus constant that protects you from that. But if nothing else, you know, you can try to say, you know, I don't see, you know, in the very naive level, and that's where it's a little wrong. The very naive level, you say, you know, I don't see any other high scale in my theory. Why am I sensitive to high scale? But the problem is that quantum mechanics sees all the particles in your theory, and they will correct your theory in that moment. Okay, so that's where those quadratic divergences show up in dimensional regularization. It is true that you will not see a direct cutoff sensitivity, and that's why you should always be skeptical about those cutoff arguments, because ultimately it's a statement about how you regularize your theory, which is not a physical thing. But the way you see it is because if you regularize even with dim reg and there is any new particles in your spectrum, the result will go like that particle's mass square. And that's where the sensitivity to high energy physics comes in. Alrighty? Okay, so let me stop here and see if you have any questions about any of those things. No, all is good? All right, so the thing that we will do in the next few lectures is to understand how this business manifests itself in the star model, and I'll do it today. But let me just go over a few of the things that showed up in the Lagrangian that we encountered. So so remind you, the Lagrangian we considered had some kinetic terms. Right, and then it had some interactions, Yukawa, psi, phi star, half, and then there is some Hermitian conjugate, and then there is some right, and importantly, there was also a mass term for phi, for psi, it looked like that, right? Now, something you might have encountered in your tutorial is that actually there is no conserved charge in this theory, right? There is a the kind of transformation you would like to do is psi goes to e to the I phi theta, right? So for this term. Right, this is the kind of transformation you want to do. If you do that, you need to do phi goes to e to the 2i theta. Right, that will keep this term invariant. Right, this term you'll get an e to the I theta from this one. You'll get an e to the I theta from here, and because this is conjugated, you'll get a minus 2i theta from the phi. And so this term is invariant under such a transformation. This term is also invariant because it's just the complex modulus squared. But which term is the problem? Which term is not invariant under this symmetry? This one, right? Psi psi, that's right. So this term will go like e to the I theta, and that's not one. There is a discrete symmetry. What kind of discrete symmetry does theory has? What kind of value of theta will actually be invariant? So this term we just see that this is the problematic term. It psi psi goes to e to the 2i theta psi psi. This is the mass term, right? So half m psi psi goes to a half m. Right? Now, how can this term actually be invariant? How can this term be such that we want e to the 2i theta to be 1? Right? What choice of theta does that? Theta equal to pi, right? So theta equal to pi is such that this theory is invariant. But you see here, this just means that this choice is just psi goes to minus psi. So this theory is invariant under this discrete symmetry where psi goes to minus itself. And do you know what group describes that? What kind of group describes this sort of transformation? So all such symmetries of the Lagrangian, are described by some group. This sort of phase rotation is what's known as the U1. right, the unitary group of dimension one. This is a discrete group. Psi goes to minus psi. Do you know which group it is? Z2, right? So this group is, this is the Z2 group. Anything I wrote is, okay. Now, this is, you might be disappointed, oh, that's all we get, we only get a discrete group. But actually, this group itself is extremely powerful. This group makes dark matter. Right now, or more generally, it makes things stable. This particle psi is now exactly stable. There is no way you can decay it. Right? This group implies that there cannot be any process where psi, whatever it is, go to anything that doesn't have an odd number of psi's in it. This process is forbidden, because it will violate psi goes to minus psi. Right? So no matter how you arrange your Lagrangian, no matter what kind of quantum mechanical processes you'll consider, you simply cannot decay this particle. This psi particle, it's some sort of spin half particle, is exactly stable. And that's important whenever you want to ask about stability. It cannot just be that, and we'll see an example of that in a moment. You cannot just say, oh, you know, I don't see any term in my Lagrangians that decays it, right? If you stare at your Lagrangian, you won't see any terms that takes a single psi into anything else. Because you may be that some quantum mechanical process generates that, right? The only way to guarantee something is stable quantum mechanically is to show that there is some symmetry that protects it from decaying, right? And Z2 is a simple enough, even though it's a very simple group, it's enough to guarantee that. Yeah. Sorry, say it again? You mean for a discrete symmetry group? Yeah. I'm not sure that there is an Nolfo theorem for a discrete symmetry group. I thought Nolfo theorem is only for continuous groups. No, there is no conserved charge associated with this. But I could be wrong. There may be some generalization of Nolfo theorem for discrete groups, but not that I know. But what you do get is the stable particle. Now, I just said that you should not trust your Lagrangian. You should not just stare at your Lagrangian and say, I don't see any interactions that decays, then I'm done. Because quantum mechanics may generate such interactions. And what I want to show you now, that in fact the Lagrangian we wrote is insufficient. Quantum mechanics will generate other interactions in this Lagrangian that we haven't specified, that we have not considered yet. Okay? So what are the kind of interactions that you can still write and we haven't written? An example of such is something that looks like, let me use it here. Why have we not written the terms that looks like this? Some new, what should we call it? Something that looks like phi square, phi modulus square, phi. And there has to be some mass dimension here, so let's call it, what's your favorite letter? Let's call it B, okay? Or mu, mu is better. Reminds you of mass, okay? So there is why did we not write a term like that? Or its complex conjugate. We haven't, but even if we haven't, fortunately, quantum mechanics keeps us honest, and we will generate this term at loop level. So let's see how whether we can write. So the way to do it is to ask yourself: is there any kind of diagram? The easiest way of doing it to start with is there any kind of diagram that I can write down that actually generates that sort of operator, and let's see if we can be creative enough to do that. So I want I want one particle coming out, right? And then another one from the phi. Remember, phi modulus square just means phi dagger or phi star. And so I want a diagram that looks like this, right? Something has to happen in between, but the arrows have to look something like that, right? Two of them are coming out. That's describing a phi and a phi. But one of the arrows have to come in. That's describing a phi star. Okay, so you understand what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to find a diagram that will generate this type of operator. So let's see if we can come up with it. I hope I won't fail miserably. But if I fail, that's a homework problem. We know that the fermion line, if phi is coming out, those two are coming in. And so for this one, it's the same thing. I have them coming in. For this one, they're both coming out. So for this one, I can just directly connect to these guys, right? But I have a problem for these two, right? For these two fermions, I see that this arrow is coming in here into this vertex, whereas this arrow is coming into that vertex. So what do you do? How do you connect them? Well, there is one operator in my theory that actually does that, and that's the mass insertion. Right? We said that the mass insertion, the operator m psi psi with a half, actually looks like that, where the two arrows flip. Okay? So let me, I don't know if you can all see it, but if you can't see it, let me just draw it here again. So I want to generate the operator phi, phi, phi star, right? This is an operator that is a three-point function, takes three fields into a single vertex. And so I want my scale, one of the scalars to come out, the other scalar to come out, and then the last scalar to come in. That's the phi star. This is phi, phi, phi star, right? And now when I try to connect them, I know that my rules are such that the Yokawa, if the scalar is coming in, the two fermions are coming out, right? That's the rule for the Yokawa. And so I have to respect it in this vertex as well. If the scalar is coming out, the two fermions have to come in. And I have to do the same here. And the only way this sort of propagator is allowed is actually if there is a mass insertion. And the x that I'm putting there is just to remind you that you're not looking at the part that is sigma dot p divided by p squared minus m squared. This is not what you want. This is the propagator that you use for this one and for this one. For this guy, you use the propagator I m over p squared minus m squared. And the difference is indeed in the spinor indices that this goes like alpha beta, where this one goes like alpha dot beta. Now, if you ever do Dirac fermions, you will never need to worry about this nonsense, because the Dirac fermion carries both the mass and the momentum at the same time. But there is some conceptual importance in being able to think about it this way, because it shows us something very profound, right? What does it tell us? That the fact that I needed to have this mass insertion, something that I would not have noticed in Dirac, what does it tell us that I needed to have this mass insertion? This diagram has to be proportional. This quantum effect has to be proportional to the mass of the fermion, right? Whatever else, whatever junk is here, doesn't really matter. It has to go like the mass of the fermion. Now, why is that? Whenever you see something like that, you should stop and think about it. It means that if the fermion mass is zero, this actually will not be generated, right? Now, this is precisely what we found, right? The only diagram, the only terms that violates the charge symmetry is the mass of the fermion. So now I'm trying to generate a new operator that very clearly violates the charge symmetry, right? This operator definitely violates. If you try to do phi goes to e to the to 2i theta phi, this operator is clearly not invariant, right? So you're now trying to generate an operator that violates the phase symmetry, and you find immediately that the only way to do that is to have another operator, namely the mass insertion, that violates the same symmetry. And this is what I mentioned to you, is that if you just naively start by writing whatever operators and be done with it, you're not being very careful. You really have to ask yourself, if I've written all the operators consistent with the symmetries, and in this case, we haven't, right? Because we have written one operator, the mass term, that violates a certain symmetry, but then we haven't written all the other operators that violate the same symmetry. Quantum mechanics keeps us honest and generates it whether we like it or not. Okay, and so that's why it's important to, this is why conceptually it's so convenient to keep the mass insertion around, because the operator that carries the mass has a different symmetries than the operator that is the kinetic term, right? The kinetic term for fermions is something that looks like psi bar sigma bar dot psi, right? And the mass term for these sort of fermions is m psi psi. This operator is invariant under the largest set of symmetries, right? Because you have the field and it's conjugate. So it's invariant even under a global continuous symmetry. This operator is not. It's invariant only under a much smaller set of symmetries. Okay? All right, so the point of this little exercise was just to show you how very clearly quantum mechanics generates for you the operators, even if you didn't write them. The only thing that quantum mechanics respect is symmetries. Okay, if your Lagrangian does not respect a certain symmetry, then you should write all the operators that violate the symmetry. Okay, they will be generated. Yeah. Not in this theory. You have to write an operator that violates this symmetry, and then that's right. So this is exactly the kind of things that the reason why these sort of arguments are so important is partially because that's the only way you can guarantee stability. Because you look at your Lagrangian and say, psi is invariant under psi is a minus psi, but then suppose I wrote an operator that looks like psi, if I had another fermion, so I have psi, 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 and some last fermion chi. All of a sudden, this symmetry is no longer true because you suddenly have this new field, right? Now, it might be that there is some larger symmetry involving the new field that still keeps things stable, but in general, then you have to worry. You have to make sure, for example, that this, because once you write this, then there is a way to decay quantum mechanically. You can do this sort of diagram, right? Psi psi psi, sorry, psi chi, and this is psi, and then you just connect this. And that creates mixing between those two states that ultimately will lead to the decay of the particles. Anyways, but the point here is that this is just a very simple example that shows you how one operator that violates a certain symmetry leads to the creation of new operators that also violate that symmetry. Okay? So in general, the way to do it is you write a Lagrangian consistent with the symmetries you have. Okay, and if you forgot terms, quantum mechanics will remind you of that. All right, so let's finish here, and then next time we'll start looking more into supersymmetry and what it implies about a star model. But the main lessons to take from today were the hierarchy problem. How do you see the hierarchy problem in dimensional regularization? What the meaning of it is, the different ways of regularizing your infinities. And ultimately, just how quantum mechanics generates operators associated with symmetries. All right? So I'll see you tomorrow, guys.